You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 461. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name's Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Join me on tonight's show out of Philadelphia or somewhere close, Mr. John Gentile.
Adam White, I just got the new Vivian Girls album in the mail today, and it is exceptional.
John, did you see that Mr. Young Gov is touring with the Vivian Girls?
Listen, when worlds collide, that's some kind of phrase. I don't know the second half of that phrase. Listen, a band I love and a band I like are playing together. I already have tickets. It's kismet. This is going to be great. It's going to be great. The Vivian Girls are amazing. Young Gov is very interesting and weird and great on his own. It looks like everybody's doing well, and that's great. Listen, that's great.
Young Gov is playing with somebody else that I saw too. Is touring with another band that I saw is playing here locally, and I can't remember who. Now I'm gonna have to look.
Ben manages to get himself onto all kinds of weird shows just because of the connections that he has. I'm pretty sure that record
Far enough from home that I assume he's doing touring that he didn't just jump on a Grand Rapids show.
Well, because he and his various songwriting and recording careers, intersect with so many crazy top of the charts pop bands, but at the same time just intersects with all these gritty hardcore bands. For example, he produced the latest record from Terror.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. So he'll go and just as Young Gov. Yeah. But play one of those shows. There was a bill that I was kicking myself for not being able to get to that was out in Buffalo, which is relatively close to me. There was a show where it was Wildside, which is like a fucking NYHC style hardcore band that's from Niagara Falls here, with Danny Romano, whose band plays this eclectic garage rocky country stuff. And Young Gov, and just totally random bills, and he'll be on one of those types of shows, and then he'll be playing with hardcore bands, and then he'll be doing a weird pop thing. His chameleonic, I don't know what the actual way to pronounce that is, but the
or
amount of
word at all.
Strange the strange ability to kind of morph that act into 25 different sounds, I think suits him well with these types of things.
Well, you know, Young Gov's got a connection to Vivian Girls, right?
We're not one or two of the Vivian Girls guested on one of them. Was it David Comes to Life?
All three Vivian Girls are on Chemistry of Common Life.
Chemistry, right. Okay, yeah.
And they used to tour together. And I not that they drifted apart, but, they kind of went into different scenes. And that made me a little bit sad because I love both those bands, and I thought that was a good pairing. But here we are, back again.
So anyways, also, I was doing the intro there. That other voice you heard was, of course, Tom Trauma.
That other sound you heard is someone flushing the toilet behind me.
I didn't hear that. I just figured that was one of our...
And my wife's watching TV very loud. I can hear it from the other room, but that's right.
Well, see, I can hear that now. This is the slice of life, right? This is what people turn into.
I have my own little sort of private room back here, but apparently it's, not always enough.
They don't want to tune in and hear
the static
NPR. They want to hear
dead silent until we start doing this, and then all of a sudden it's it'd be a great time to rearrange the pots and pans.
I shudder to think how it's going to be recording the show when my kids are old enough to be awake when I record the show, because right now that's not happening. So,
I mean, we all have our occasional issues, dog with diarrhea and whatnot. But yeah, what are you gonna do?
So yeah. So anyways, this has been a fair warning to anyone tuning into the show. one of those weeks, which is to say we went and we looked upon the world of music news and we went, eh. So we grabbed some stuff from the list that, like,
John actually talked about getting the new Vivian Girls record. We haven't talked record collecting for a long time, guys. You guys got anything interesting? Because I have been just buying so much more than I have time to listen to.
We can absolutely go there because I don't know, but we haven't done that in a while. You know what, John, why don't we, before we get into the mail, let's do that. Let's chat a little bit about it.
I forgot that we'd have to listen to John's list to make my own pretty decent list look pathetic.
Well, so John, what have you dug in the crates and from the mail orders
I'm on the spot. Well, okay, here's one really interesting thing that I got. One of the fun things about collecting reggae is that not often, but sometimes the Jamaican version of the record is different sound recordings or different masterings or different mixes than what's called the international record version. That's basically the version everyone else got. I did not know this, but Bunny Wailer's first album, which is called Black Hearted Man, which everyone agrees is his best album and is one of the greatest reggae albums of all time. It's a fairly calm sounding album, but it's got Bunny Wailer's beautiful falsetto and it's got some pretty heavy concepts and it's got a lot of neat and weird sounds in it. The Jamaican version is different. And I was lucky enough to pick up a Jamaican version. It's actually like a $100 record, but I picked up a really beat cop. I mean, these days everyone wants mint records. I'm kind of a bottom feeder in that, you know, sometimes I'm willing to take kind of a beat up record just to get it so I can hear it, you know. So being the bottom feeder that I am, I got a $15 version of Jamaican version of Bunny Wailer's Black Hearted Man album. And it was a revelation. It does sound like most Jamaican versions. It sounds a little grittier, a little heavier sonically, thicker, murkier, but also there's a whole bunch of different sounds. And most interestingly, the closing track, and a couple of the other tracks, I believe, as well, but the closing track is This Train, which is an old, 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 old soul song, which you've probably heard. This train is bound for glory. It's like a minute and a half longer, and the Jamaican version, like the last few minutes, is just like these weird, interesting dub effects that come after this beautiful song. So it goes from like this beautiful, I would almost say church song, to this weird, dark, kind of scary dub thing, and then it fades out, which you don't hear on the international version. So that's one of the fun things about collecting Jamaican music, is that the Jamaican versions often are, sometimes are different, and honestly, they're kind of more avant-garde a lot of the time. The second thing that I got is something that I've had for a while, except for I haven't. I've had the CD version of Integrity's Humanity is the Devil for about 10 years now. Humanity is the Devil is probably my favorite or second favorite Integrity record. And the whole album is about how Dwed Hellion of Integrity thinks humans are horrible and terrible and should be wiped off the planet. And the only way to fix the cycle of reincarnation that we're in which after you die, you get reincarnated back on Earth and Earth is actually hell. The only way to fix it is to kill all life all at once. That's basically Dwed Hellion's thing. I recently picked up a CD version of Humanity is the Devil, and I was lucky enough that it has the rare booklet inside. And what the booklet is inside is it's a literal religious tract that Dwed Hellion took and modified from the Process Church of Final Judgment. Tom and Adam, do you know what the Process Church of Final Judgment is?
I do not. Is it like Jim Jones or something?
It's very much related to that. Yes, the Process Church split off from Proto Scientology. So before Scientology was Scientology, it was Dianetics, and the Process Church was split.
I read that book. My gosh, I wish I had those hours back.
by a guy called De Grimson, and he kind of took Scientology and merged it with Gnosticism, with polytheism, and Satanism, and he kind of had this new-ish religion called the Final Church of Holy Judgment or something. And basically, the whole thing of that is that we're all the byproduct of a creator that doesn't know what it's doing, that is the byproduct of another creator, and we're trapped in this cycle of horrible reincarnation. I don't agree with any of it, but I find it fascinating and amusing to a degree. Anyways, so you guys know what those Jack Trick Jack – well – sometimes you'll go back to your car. There's like a religious tract like on under your windshield, you know.
Sure.
So this is came in some copies of the record, and most people lost it. It's a religious tract that's got Abraxas on the front. Abraxas is a Gnostic deity that kind of represents the destruction of the universe, if you will, and it's basically a religious tract about why everyone is, all humans are terrible and we're trapped in this unending thing. And it kind of contradicts itself in lots of areas, and it's amusing and interesting, and I find it fascinating.
Religious dogma that contradicts itself? What are the odds?
Last thing that I'm going to talk about is, let's see, I've got a lot of interesting things recently, honestly. I've been spending too much money on records. I gotta cut back.
You and me both, dude. Yeah. You and me both.
So this is something more common. World Inferno Friendship Society just re-released three records. Just the Best Party, the first album, Bridgewater Astral League, and their compilation album, Super Sounds of Punk Today. The Just the Best Party remaster is excellent. The clarity it makes the record just better. The biggest boost, I think, is the Bridgewater Astral League. That's World Inferno's first record, and that's the one that people tend to say is like their least favorite or maybe most overlooked. And I think the reason for that is because that record is from 1997. There's a lot of sounds on that record, and they were all kind of muddy together. The remastered version separates the sound, and it's one of the few instances where heavily remastering a record really has improved it. Often when they heavily remaster a record, then it makes it too loud, and certain sounds get buried. The best example would be the most recent David Bowie remasters, which are actually not that good. But the World Inferno for the Bridgewater Astral League remaster is fantastic, much like the Crass remasters. It separates the sound so you can finally hear what the band was intending, and instead of it being a mess of noise, it's different instruments interacting with each other, and really it's a revelation. It's a very well done remaster. And that's what I picked up recently.
What about you, Tom? You said you've been
I've been on a binge, man, a binge. First, it started with and I have this thing, and I know you guys do too, probably, but where I'm buying the same records over and over again for like 30 years. But the first thing I Boris the Sprinkler just put out a new record. I like it quite a bit. You know Boris Adam, kind of a fun. They were mainly a 90s band, kind of a, I wouldn't exactly call them pop punk, but sort of in that vein. They sort of ran in the Screeching Weasel, Mr. T Experience kind of circles.
And then it ran in like the Lookout circles back in the day.
No, they didn't. They never did anything with Lookout, but yeah, I mean, yeah, they were never on the label, but yeah, they definitely kind of were in that thing.
Like, but so they toured with those sorts of.
Yeah, and they were from Green Bay, so they were kind of like one of those. You know, it's like any town that has a scene, usually there's like one key linchpin band. Smaller towns, I should say, not necessarily, you know, like in New York or Philadelphia, but, you know, like a Green Bay, if there's a scene in Green Bay, it's usually because there's a linchpin band, and they were always kind of a linchpin band. Anyway, they put out their first album in 20 years. So I'm like, oh, I got to get that. So I got a bunch of Beer City stuff, Beer City Records out of Milwaukee. Great, great label for like old guys like me, because it's mostly because all the newer bands are sort of like these hard punk and thrash bands, but they also do a lot of reissues and stuff. But anyway,
excellent reissue of MDC's first record on Beer City.
Yes,
excellent.
And all the DRI catalog and the, or not the catalog, because there's some legal issues after the first three or four albums. Also, they've done a bunch of MDC stuff. The band The Faction, if you remember that, it was a skateboarder called Steve Caballero's band, the good skate punk band. And there's been a few different things like that. They reissued the Best Toxic Reasons album. They've done a bunch of different bands over the years. So anyway, I ordered the new Boris record, vinyl only, 1,000 copies. So I ordered that, and I also ordered the Restarts MDC Split. John, you know that one?
Yes,
full LP split.
That's got Pirate Love, not Pirate Love, Zombie Love on it, and it's got a song called "It Can Happen" by MDC. Which is an extremely beautiful and extremely haunting song.
I actually don't have them in front of me right now. I mean, I can see them. They're like three arm lengths away. So I got that as an LP. And I also got Reverend Norb's first band in Green Bay before Boris the Sprinkler. There was a band called Suburban Mutilation. So I got their record on blue vinyl. And I got the, I got Boris on black. And then I got the what color was the MDC one? It was a green or red or something. I can't remember. But I also got a few key 7 inches that I really didn't need because I have pretty much all this material on other things. But I got the first 7 inch from D. Crutzen, which is called Cows and Beer, another Milwaukee band. I got the most recent DRI 7 inch, and I got another band, kind of obscure Midwestern punk / hardcore band from the early 80s that put out one classic 7-inch. They're called the Clip Boys. So I got the reissue of their 7-inch. And I also got another thing I didn't need but wanted, a 7-inch on blood red vinyl of DRI's Violent Pacification EP, one of my favorites. So I got that box, and I'm still not quite done listening to it all yet. But then I've been going to some shows lately, and I picked up some more stuff that I don't need. Including a clear copy of the Dirty Rotten EP or Dirty Rotten LP. Originally, it was the Dirty Rotten EP, which it was a 22 song 7-inch, but it's been, this is a reissue on Beer City. It's the clear 12-inch, same 22 songs, lasts about, I don't know, 12 minutes, 14 minutes or something. I bought that at a DRI show I went to recently, and I also bought a double LP of a band called Death Wish, who's a cool, like, Motorhead influenced crossover band from Wisconsin. And what else did I buy? Oh, and I picked up another copy of the Zero Boys, Vicious Circle. What? They were a great hardcore band from Indiana. Sorry, Adam, did you lose me? I'm here.
Did no one see that? What just happened?
What happened?
I've been gone for like 5 minutes. Like, my computer died and turned off and vanished.
Nice. Are you the one recording?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
We got nothing.
Well, I've got the backup.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. John, you're amazing.
All right.
Well, continue.
I was just soliloquizing anyway, Adam.
I was ready to nuke the whole show. So
you were backup? Because you went, okay, Tom, what'd you get? And I literally was just wrapping up talking about what I got, trying to think if I got anything else. Yes.
And we have all of it on John's recording.
Yes,
hell yes.
That
including this conversation.
So, I mean, so what that says is well, it says three things. One, whatever you just said was either incredibly engrossing, or at least to you, or entirely inconsequential. I'll never know.
Probably both.
It says that my computer that I use to make my living is in a dangerous zone of unknown something that because that was a weird happening. It was like a light switch. It was not a normal sort of like your computer is going to turn off situation. It was just like ding and it was gone, which is I don't know. And it says I can just vanish from this show for several minutes and it doesn't matter. So. I guess that,
there you
that,
go.
I'm not.
We missed important. You, Adam.
All right, so I take
Where'd
it that
you
were talking about all these cassettes I was about to mention. So I guess it's not. I shouldn't.
Yes, you know I'm a huge collector of Canadian cassettes.
You're a huge collector of weird Canadian cassettes, right? All right, here's my thing. I just looked upon my pile of media that I keep not putting in the Discogs and not putting on the shelf, and I kind of have a personal rule that it should go into Discogs before it goes onto the shelf, or else it vanishes from all walk of life. And I looked upon my pile here, and I'm like, oh, what should I talk about on this record collecting section of the show? And I'm like, everything that excites me to talk about are tapes, and I don't know what that. But then I went and I opened up one of them.
It means you're a hipster, Adam. It means you're full hipster.
I mean, I guess, but like I went and I picked up one of them and I'm looking at it and like it instantly in like three or four ways made me happy in ways that other things don't right now. So there's a band that I played.
Tom, what do you think that means? That obtuse statement, you know what I mean? Other things don't make me happy. What does that mean?
It didn't mean like, like sunshine and flowers don't make me happy. I mean, they don't like explicit. It wasn't a statement.
Adam has filled his life with sex and drugs and rock and roll. And the only thing that makes him happy right now is cassettes.
The only thing that makes me happy is cassettes. The only way I can get high anymore is to.
And look do you, at you have a, you have a cassette player in your stereo, huh?
I am a chronic collector of baby boomers discarded cassette decks from their home stereo stacks. So I'll be over at someone's house and I'll be in their basement for whatever reason. And there'll be like a pile of stereo equipment in the corner. I'd be like, what are you doing with that tape deck? And they're like, take the fucker. And I'm like, thank you. And then I just acquire them and they come here and they live here with me in a pile. That is when they're going to bury me. And then they're going to find my corpse under a bunch of tape decks. I have one that is currently like hooked into my stereo setup at the moment. I need a splitter so I can split between my amp between my turntable and the tape deck, because I have to unplug things right now, which, you know, makes me feel like an idiot. But yeah, it's there. I have one. It is used. But in any case, I was looking at the pile and there's kind of this scuzzy punk band that I played in the show a few weeks ago called Barnacle that kind of had this underwater sea sound. I was babbling about the Sex Pistols submission, I think, when I was trying to compare them to something. But so they played Sappy Fest when I was there, and I grabbed the tape from them from the merch table, and I'm looking at it right now, and it's Barnacle. It says Sappy 14 promo tape. I go and I take it out of its little case, and inside it says 20 of 25. And I'm like, that kind of thing makes me happy. Is it like you get these, like you get these little weird punk bands where, you know, they're that you being in a scuzzy lo-fi punk band called Barnacle from Montreal means that you are probably never going to make one red cent doing what you're doing ever. So you're never going to be in a position.
Making 25 of something is certainly not going to put you in a good position. I happen to know, I know a tape mogul who probably knows better than I do, and he might even be on hand, so he could probably tell you better than me. But
Barnacle is not, you know, without severely financially limiting someone that's in that band, going to go print, you know, 257 inches or something like that. So like there's a lot of these like small little bands where like they want to put something out into the world that is a real thing. And
is 25 tapes a real thing?
25. Well, it's a thing. It exists. It's here. I'm talking about it. I mean, I can touch
25.
It. I guess there's 25
of you that are excited about it. Maybe.
Yeah, but that's okay. That's all that matters.
But you're a tastemaker. Exactly. You're an influencer, Adam.
I do taste things.
You're like Kim Kardashian with, you know, just a fraction of the audience, but still you're like Kim Kardashian.
You're like Kim Kardashian, a fraction of the audience without the looks, without the gigantic fan base.
Or the gigantic ass.
You know, the thing that I learned about the Kardashians that really blew my mind.
I like how Adam pronounced it Kardashian, not Kardashian, Kardashian. I like that, Adam.
It's a Canadian pronunciation. It's got an extra U in it.
What did I call them?
Like color.
You say Kardashian like one like a person might say instead of negotiation. You know what I mean?
Oh, like no, you know what I did? I was not saying it like that. I was saying it like the fucking Kardashians, I think. Isn't that the name of the race on Deep Space Nine?
Kardashians.
Yeah. Wow. That's all.
I went from bad to worse.
No, see, okay, so yes, old episodes of Star Trek is how I'm trying to retreat from this horrible hell world that we live in. But in any case,
well, I think Kim Kardashian is fair because, like the Kardashians, Kim Kardashian has annihilated entire races for her own profitable goodness. But she has a sense of style despite it. You know what I mean? So
yeah, and she's a subservient pawn of the Dominion. What someone told me once is, so when Canada went and legalized marijuana, there was a big question about who was going to get the contract for selling it online. And there's this company out of Ottawa that's a big e-commerce company, and I don't need to advertise them on here, but they exist. And they got the contract to go make like the officially government sanctioned online store. And everyone was interviewing them for the news articles and stuff like that before the store opened, where they were saying, you know, how are you going to handle this crush of people rushing in for the first time, for the first day to buy, you know, to buy on your online store? Like, how are you not just going to completely, you know, lose your shit that day? And the online shopping company was like, we handle, and I don't know which of the Kardashians it is. I'm sorry. So I don't know which of them there are, like,
Frank
or Chloe or Stinky, whatever. Like they're like, we handle Stinky Kardashian lipstick drops. So a lipstick drop compared to like starting selling legal weed in the country of Canada is a way bigger event. And I had to go look this up to understand what this is, but I guess one of them has like a cosmetics brand, and they will release exclusive variants or what. I don't even know what the word is. If I'm saying variants, like it's a color of vinyl, right? They will release exclusive, lipstick editions onto the internet via Instagram, and people rush in and will buy like 100,000 of these things out in the matter of a few minutes. And this was used as the example of the most extreme online shopping thing that could ever happen. And compared to that, starting to sell legal weed for the first time was like no fucking big deal. So that's literally all I know about the Frangie or whoever we're talking about. But anyways, yeah. So this Barnacle tape, I don't know. It makes me happy. Like it's super limited. It's weird. It has no value to anyone but me, but it is a physical artifact that I'm holding in my hand, and I like that. And everything I grabbed from my pile is, I think, stuff that is in that category. There's this cool band from Ottawa that's called The Shame. They have a release that they put out called The Pops, The Pits. If you ever have a chance to see The Shame, they are the weirdest looking band. Their singer is sort of like I don't know how to describe it, like a weird looking version of Andrew WK fronting a really strange garage pop band, but they were great. I've got a tape sitting here from the Montreal indie pop band BBQT that has like the two EPs that they had released on Bandcamp earlier that they had gone and pressed to a tape. But I'm looking at it and like, so they went and they put out 2 6-song EPs between, you know, over the course of a year on Bandcamp. When those were online and digital, I went and I listened to them the one or two times that they were there and, you know, added them to my iTunes library, whatever the fuck you do with digital music. But then I thought like, all right, there, like I've acquired those things in the way that you acquire things online. It doesn't matter to me. It certainly wasn't special, but I'm holding this tape and it's sparkly. And the cover art's all kind of like someone wrote it with a marker. And I'm like, this is wonderful. I'm so glad that I have this thing. So this is what I'm advocating for on this record collecting segment is go buy weird tapes from small bands that have no money. And they are just strange, strange little things that can live in your office.
And if a band becomes famous and you can say, I've got the OG, OG, OG tape, baby.
Yeah. And then sell it to dummies.
It could triple in value. It might be worth like $12 one day.
Hey, man, that Vaporwave cassette is worth like $3,000.
My gosh.
Like, would you ever pay $3,000 for Macintosh Plus?
I wouldn't pay $3,000 for most things, but...
That is like the... that's the never mind the bollocks of Vaporwave there.
It is, it is.
That is the big important one.
And have you ever heard it?
Yeah, I have actually, because I went down this weird road where all of a sudden, I don't know, like I saw I don't know, it might have been one of those Bandcamp articles or something like that, where like at one point the internet was like, had this like, hey, remember Vaporwave kind of retrospective? And my answer to that was, I don't know what that is, and it sounds like you made it up. And I went down this several evening Vaporwave trail, whereas I didn't believe that was a genre, because the whole thing read like an Onion article or like a Clickhole thing. Like it read as fiction. And then as I'm following it, I'm like, this isn't just so much like sarcastic fiction. This is some weird like William Gibson's cyberpunk dystopia fiction, where like none of this media sounds like it should exist or that anyone would actually want to listen to it. And I was convinced that it was all just like a sham. People are putting out these things not because it was a functioning scene, but because they believe, but because it was like a fictional scene that they were all contributing into. Like it was some sort of strange postmodern like cultural reaction to a culture that didn't actually exist kind of thing. some really like, you know, Guy Debord crazy shit. But I still don't even know if it exists or if it was just like a strange internet phenomenon. But
the thing with that, I was listening to it. I'm like, yeah, this is actually kind of interesting. And then I'm like, man, this song sounds familiar. The whole tape is just like 80s, what they call freestyle, not freestyle rap, but freestyle. The whole tape is 80s freestyle, which is kind of like CNC Music Factory sort of. Slow down and other sound effects put on top. That's all it is.
Yeah, it's as I understand it, it is basically like the Muzak from a Kmart in like 1987 just played at halftime. And
right,
but not
right.
but just like but not even like covered, but just like someone pulled it into GarageBand and turned the tempo down and then like dropped some like Windows 95 noises on top of it and then put it onto the internet, and it's a thing. And on the one hand, like, I feel that like as a person that supports, you know, the music of, you know, guys with guitars that are driving around in a van trying to play a show, like that type of thing should be the antithesis of what I'm about. But it's not like these like vaporwave weirdos are out there conquering the world or like selling out arenas either. They're just other fucked up strangeoids that are like sitting in their basement making weird shit. And I can kind of respect that.
I think we're just made that we didn't think of it first and make that sweet, sweet money.
Money?
Hey, can't we get one copy of this cassette and then we could team up with Narma Records to bootleg the hell out of it?
Well, we could bootleg it right now. We just download the MP3s.
There you go. But I want the tape to look authentic.
Hey,
I want to
sell $3,000. You actually had like a really good idea. We can bootleg the tape, sell it for crazy amounts, and Macintosh Plus can't sue us because they haven't legally licensed the underlying sound recordings.
There you go.
Wow.
Well, it's like, you know, there's stuff that I would love to see get reissued for whatever reason it's tied up in legal stuff. You know, you can't tell me that you couldn't find some obscure pressing plant that would press you bootleg Necros albums, because they don't know who Necros is. You could pass that off for whatever you wanted, you know.
That stuff's all over. You know, I mean, I see that stuff all the time, like bootleg Misfits, bootleg Necros, bootleg this, bootleg that.
Yeah. But I'm talking about like good quality, full, you know, original recording.
Well, actually,
Misfits. I don't know if that exists in Necros, because there are enough originals floating around, but they're expensive.
So are you aware, John or Tom, of the like late 80s phenomenon that was called plunderphonics?
Plunderphonics?
No. Plunderphonics, like as it plunder is in steel, right? So plunderphonics was an EP and an album released in like, I want to say like 87, 88, 89 or something like that by this guy named, John Oswald. And what he did was he went and created these cut up records of it was basically like it was sampling and like aggressively reworking all of these existing recordings in a way that like I guess was like was concurrent with hip hop doing a lot of the same type of sampling stuff, but it was separate from it and sort of came at it in more of this in this culture jamming this aggressive sort of like pre-internet cut and paste of the culture postmodern thing. So the Plunderphonics recordings that kind of like originally came out, they reworked stuff by like basically by everyone that would sue you. So like it stole and reworked pieces of music by the Beatles and by Michael Jackson and all this stuff, and created these big crazy soundscapes based on it. And you can't really get that stuff anymore because of course like the estate of Michael Jackson sued them into the ground when they tried to put this stuff out originally. But it was a huge influence on basically like any kind of like weird experimental electronic music, like primarily let's say like the Residents, like a lot of those kind of like weirdo bands that kind of like emerged in the 80s, they were,
if by Residents emerging in the 80s you mean like 1973, is that what you mean by the Residents, Adam?
Yeah, that's what I meant, the eyeball band, right? So they were in the 70s, yeah, but like it was
negative land. It's more like negative land, I think, in the 80s.
Yeah, so the Plunderphonics movement was, I'm butchering it because I'm just kind of like running off memory here, but like it was hugely influential in that type of realm, right? Where the kind of stuff that you would hear on like a college radio station at 3 a.m. in the 90s, right? Like just like the weirdest shit that just aggressively just took from everything and cut and pasted and sampled and put it back together in a way that was like super aggressively anti-commercial. So like you could never really accuse them of trying to run out there and like use this music and not pay the original recordings, because there was sort of like this very like punk rock, like fuck you aspect to it, where they were just, you know, just taking all these works and just like bastardizing them in these like scary ways. And in a way, like Vaporwave, like I think at its best, kind of kicks back to that spirit. And I'm like, it's never anything sonically that I would really want to sit down and listen to, because a lot of it is just like weird shit that is intentionally weird. But I can appreciate the nihilism. Are we talking about record collecting? See, this is a good show.
A lot of things that I don't know anything about.
He's got people, Tom, they're breaking the rules and giving the finger to the man. That's all you care about.
I do like that.
I think I finally get the Residents, honestly. I think I'm finally getting it. In that, like the Residents, you listen to the Residents, you're like, what am I listening to? But the point of the Residents isn't music. It's more like a movie for your ears. And so like when you listen to a Residents record, don't think, how am I going to rock out this or listen to this again? Just think, I'm in this world. Let's see what happens next. And I know a lot of people that like the Residents, and from an objective standpoint, they're like, this is a really interesting band. They've got hundreds of records and they're all wildly different from each other. And you listen to it and it's like just noise, you know, but I got that. It's called like Eskimo or something. Eskimo. I got a copy of Eskimo because I got it used for like $3 and I listened to it. And I'm like, oh, this is actually kind of interesting in that it's not a musical record. It's a sonic experience or a sonic journey. And if you think of it that way, I think that's kind of the way to appreciate the Residents, if you will.
I keep going down that road with artists, and it's clicking for me to appreciate them on that level. But I feel that for a lot of people that approach music strictly from like a pop songwriting standpoint, it just seems like a bunch of dumb noise. And it's not because they don't get it, but it's because it just doesn't meet the goal that they've set out to, that they're looking for this audio to set out and achieve in their lives. Like, what is today? Today Wednesday? So Monday night I was at the Polaris Music Prize Gala in Toronto with all the kind of Canadian music industry bigwigs and everything. So, you know, I wore a shirt that was ironed and I was clean. And I went to this big shot industry event thing, and all of the, well, like 9 of the 10 artists that were nominated for the, or shortlisted for the Polaris Prize played sets at it. And like the big one from like this podcast's perspective was Pup played it. And, you know, they played three songs right at the start of the night. The way this thing was kind of staged was that, each of the bands played two or three songs, whatever they could kind of fit into the span of, say, like a no longer than like 10 or 15 minute performance. Like 15 minutes was long. Let's say 10 minutes. They had 10 minutes on stage. And then what they would do is they would break down the stage in between each band playing for 15 minutes. And because this was like a broadcasted, televised thing, it was sort of like an award show or a... it was probably like filmed the way that like a lot of live television was filmed, which is that like there'd be parts where like the show would stop because they would have to reset the stage, and then they would be like, all right, everyone, like be back in 15 minutes, And then you get back in 15 minutes, you like start to applaud as the camera and the host kind of came back on and that all got stitched together. So Pup played the first thing and they played the last song that they played on it was, it was like Full Blown Meltdown, I think, which is like the big aggressive yelly song that's on Morbid Stuff. And that at the time that they played it, seemed like, I'm like, this is really aggressive for this room that they're in. Like, there's a lot of more poppy songs that are on that last Pup record, but they had gone and they had purposefully, you know, in front of all these moneyed and influential people, played like their loudest and craziest song. And, you know, I can respect that. That was kind of fun that they went and they did that and that they took the opportunity to be loud in that space. But later in the night, one of the shortlisted records, and the one that's been shortlisted sort of bewilderingly to, I think, everyone in the straight and buttoned up part of the Canadian music industry, was a band that I played a few weeks ago on this show called Fetnat. And Fetnat was that band that played like just like aggressively weird, super skronky, like punk jazz, where they're just, there's a guy yelling in French and a bass player and a drum and a saxophone, and it's all just making squelching crazy noise over the course of a few minutes. And I was really excited to see them play because of all the artists that night, they were the ones with nothing to lose because they were not going to win the Polaris Prize for all sorts of political reasons. Like, they weren't going to win. And the fact that they were even there, I think, threw a lot of people for a loop. So this was really their chance to get onto a big, like, national, I don't know if it was nationally televised per se, but I want to say like a stage with national attention and just be weird in everyone's faces. And that's totally what they did. And they got up and they played, like, I'm sure it was two or three songs that they played, although you wouldn't be able to tell the difference when one song ended and one song started, because it was just a lot of like crazy French yelling as someone went bananas on a saxophone and, you know, and this seizure inducing light show happened behind them. And I thought a lot about how the room was reacting to it. Whereas if I was an old guy that was sitting at a table and I was there because, you know, I'm from some big nonprofit arts organization and I'm putting a lot of money into these Canadian cultural programs and whatever, and here's this band on stage that's basically like, fuck you, we're going to molest a saxophone for 5 minutes, right? That guy's sitting there being like, you know, dropping his monocle into his martini or whatever. But I'm watching it being like, this is amazing, because these guys are just, they're just going fucking crazy. And I'm into it from the, like, look at how far these guys are pushing the envelope standpoint. And I feel like with a lot of this, like, weird, like, residence style stuff, it's that you're really latching onto is just that, like I'm going on a strange audio adventure with these people. And I'm perfectly okay if I can't sing a bar of it afterwards. And I don't know if that is something that comes naturally to you or if that is a place where you have to get. Because a lot of this weird shit that I would have sat down and tried to listen to it like 10 years ago even, and I would have been like, this is like unlistenable chaos noise and I don't like it.
Well, there's the name of our we three bands, Chaos Noise. So let's read some mail. I don't even know if we're going to get to news today or not, but let's read some mail. And then,
I'm trying my hardest to go on diversions that will keep us away from this stinky pile of news. Oh, absolutely.
I actually just saw another story that we don't have on our list that we'll talk about in a minute.
Well, this is from QBT, and you can always use that podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. I feel that you don't give enough respect to emo. I listen to the podcast every week. Well, most weeks. But all you talk about is John and Hardcore, Tom and Midwestern Funk, and Adam and bands no one has heard. Why don't you focus?
Adam got the worst of that interaction.
Why don't you focus to cover every genre, or if you don't know a genre, bring on a guest for that week? That way everyone gets something. I do like the podcast, but you can be insular. Plus, emo is great. Isn't it great to have feelings? Except your feelings. From QBT.
No. No. Midwesterners never accept their feelings. That's part of growing up in the Midwest.
Isn't emo from the Midwest?
I have no idea. You know who's our we have a couple of, well, let's say, I don't know if Sean doesn't do much anymore. I don't know if he's around much anymore, but he was our emo kid.
Yeah, way too many emo kids. I think aside from us three, I think everybody at the site is an emo kid.
You know, it's true because right. I know John, and I don't know if you did any of this, but you know we're working on a retro reviews from a certain year, and some of these kids are so excited they're literally like mauling over each other like animals to get at these things. And I'm looking at the releases that year and going, eh. Like I picked a couple just for fun, but it was, you know, and that, you know, these are the 90s retro reviews, not the 70s retro reviews. The 70s retro reviews, we hit a gold mine in 1979. But anyway, do you agree with that 1999 sentiment or not particularly, John?
Oh, the late 90s through mid 2000s was rough for punk all around.
And that's the way I feel about it too. But like I said, these kids are so excited about this. I'm just like, ugh. There was a few scraps being thrown around that I was interested in that era, but that was about it. 2000s were a good time for me to be out of the game.
You picked the right era, Tom.
I picked the right era to have children.
Every time you say that, I feel negligent. Like I should be checked out right now because I have young children. And
you're Adam, you're listening to cassettes that are in limited editions of 25. You're pretty much checked out. I wouldn't worry about getting any more checked out if I were you.
I guess. I
didn't entirely check out. I just wasn't as receptive to listening to newer stuff because I didn't feel like I had the time. Like I still follow my favorite bands, the big bands, but I just don't feel like I'm super well educated on that 2000 to 2010 decade, which I believe is your decade of emo, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of interested to dive in.
I would totally weep along with this guy who wrote this letter if I could, but I can't. I feel no emotion.
I'm interested to kind of dive into this because I was...
That makes one of us.
Well, not because I have a particular love or appreciation or even deep knowledge of emo, but more because I'm interested in like the sociology of this. Like why did the three of us not go down this road or what turned us off of it or anything, right? So before the show, because I knew that John had this email in his holster, I sat there and I tried to like scribble out where my intersections
pros and cons of emo.
Well, not pros and cons, but like at what point did I get on and off the train, let's say. So I mean if you want to talk about it from like a classic from this like unimpeachable classic emo stuff that no one's going to complain about, right? All that is fine to me, but I would have not recognized it as emo at the time. So like the usual things people trot out when they're talking about it, like Embrace and Rites of Spring and you know, aspects of Fugazi and stuff like that, right? So I before anyone, because like this happens to, I think, everybody when you get into something is that at some point some musical dickhead will show up and be like, well, actually, what you like isn't the real this. The real this is from there, right? Well, that was what like all those Discord bands were for everyone that was getting into emo, I think, in the late 90s and early 2000s, right? Someone would show up and be like, well, Rites of Spring, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, okay. Yes. And if you go listen to Rites of Spring or any of those bands, you know, I have nothing to complain about with any of them. I certainly don't go back to any of those bands to the same degree that I would Fugazi, but I have no qualm with them at all. So my kind of contemporary intro to what I understood as emo, and I think that like putting a marker on the year by year calendar here is important because the definition changed so much in the course of like, was it like let's say like 99 to like 2004, I feel like the definition of what anyone considered emo shifted like two times a year. And depending on when you identify with it, there may be like you may have been totally on board with what was called emo in 2000. What was called emo in 2002 was reprehensible to you. And I feel like that was my kind of experience with it. So honestly, like what I understood as being emo, one of the first bands that people were calling that I was hearing and listening to would have been Hot Water Music. Because there was a time, like, and this is like would have been before Hot Water Music signed to Epitaph, and even before, I want to say like before Hot Water Music was playing too much like straight ahead rock and roll kind of songs, is that like that band was considered like up and down an emo band. And I remember that like Scott Heisel, when he was writing for the site, Hot Water Music had a record come out in 99, refer, because it's called No Division. And let's see here, when was No Division come out? No Division came out in, yeah, it was 99. It came out in 99 on some records, right? And No Division was controversial amongst this fervent online, like message board based music community, that because it was like had more of a rock and roll bent than the previous two or three records that band had out, because their earlier stuff was lo-fi and it was muddy and it was a lot of like dueling guitars with like vocals really low in the mix, and as I understood it, that was the sound of emo. Like it sounded like hardcore bands playing like a half step slower than they normally would. And, you know, like basically bands in the 2000s that started listening to like Husker Du and making records that sounded like, I don't know, like New Day Rising or something like that, but with even less of a budget. And that was what I
understood. Sounds great. Right? Sounds great.
But like
New Day Rising is a great album.
But that's what I understood. I'm like, okay, so like that was what I could that was like what I could draw a line from. Like I would listen to Hot Water Music of that era and go like, okay, so this is, you know, I get the hardcore connection, but they're not playing at that speed, and they're really embracing sort of like the fuzz and the weirdness and stuff like that that a band like Husker Du could get into, right? So like that was my understanding of it. And as bands started to emerge that were cleaner than that is where I started to get suspicious of it. And then when bands started to emerge that embraced the aspect that kind of that in my mind is like suburban shopping mall emo, that embraced this, we're gonna sing nice, clean, gentle verses with aggressive throat peeling screaming in the choruses and all this, like I was completely off for any of that. And I remember trying to sit down and listen to a lot of that stuff when it was really blowing up and becoming popular, but it just never worked for me. So you look at a band like, say, like Thursday, that was maybe like the most popular of that era. And I tried and legitimately tried to sit down and listen to like a record like Thursday's Full Collapse and be like, why do people like this? And like, I'm sure I owned a copy of that record at some point, because, you know, when you're getting into stuff and you're still youngish, you know, when all of a sudden, you know, the punk scene, quote unquote, is like, this is the record, you got to check it out and get on board, you know, you're going to go, okay, I'll go check out a copy of that. And so there were records like that, but like it never brought me joy. Like it never spoke to me in a way that made me happy in any which way. Right now, I was coming off the late 90s being a huge ska kid, right? So I think that was partly working against me, where I was approaching punk rock as, you know, so it started as being like this big, fun, dumb, you know, teenage misfit dance music for me, and then it transitioned into this and then I started getting into all the 70s stuff, right? So it was all this like this snotty-nosed, anti-authoritarian, you know, punk. And then to all of a sudden, like, go from that, from going down that road and to lurch into something like Thursday, I'm not, I don't have these vulnerable, you know, light switch into screaming feelings that they are trying to express. Like, this is not connecting with me in a way that is making any sense. And it got to a while where I used to look at that stuff and it all seemed to me like, it seemed to be like dumb kids music. Like it seemed like stuff that trendy kids in the mall were into and that I wasn't because I was smarter than them. And I remember that there was stuff that I legitimately wrote off without looking into because it seemed to fit that pattern. So my local one would have been Alexis on Fire that actually, when they started out, they had that exact thing. Right. So, you know, Dallas Green is singing all these kind of like nice, you know, very, 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 very accomplished, you know, emotive vocals. And then you've got George in there just sort of like screaming his head off. And I'm just like, no, I remember like coming home from university and going to the mall in Welland, Ontario, because like they were a local band here. So they were huge here kind of before anywhere else. And seeing that cover art everywhere in like the CD store when they still had them at the mall. And just being like, what the fuck is wrong with kids in high school these days? Like, this is trash and these kids are wrong. And I reject all of this. And then soon after that, things got popular. And when they got popular and I was already anti, the popular was just like confirming all of my biases against it. So you would have, say, bands like My Chemical Romance that would all of a sudden pop up and become popular. And they had then the budget to go out and to be ridiculous and to kind of like, and being that band had like more glammy aspects to them, but they leaned into it in a way that like we could look at it and be like, oh, so now this like dumb emo band is wearing eyeliner and it's just, it's silly and it's infecting the rest of the punk scene because now look, Billy from Green Day is wearing eyeliner too. Cause he's trying to lean into the eyeliner crowd and just like, and so much of it that I was just like kicking my feet against from like that point forward. And it took a while for me to actually circle back to any of those bands. And it felt like I circled back to them once they kind of went off genre, like off the pattern. So like, so I got into Alexis on Fire like way later in life. And it was only because they started recording, like aggressive hardcore sounding rock and roll records that didn't really have that early sound. And at that point I was like, oh, okay. Like I'm actually kind of into this. I'm cool with this. Or then I look at say a band like, The Promise Ring, where I was never into that. I was never into their early stuff because the Promise Ring's early stuff was it fit my narrative of this, you know, this being a band playing sort of like tepid, overwrought, kind of like pop punk informed pop punk, but was not written for me. It was like, was written for like this, I'm sure this person that didn't really exist, but what I had decided was like 15-year-old girls. Right. And so I was never into any of those early Promise Ring records. I still haven't heard any of those early Promise Ring records, but then they went to at some point, they went and they recorded a record for Anti, for like the Epitaph sublabel called Woodwater. That was, I guess, completely different sounding than any of their normal stuff. It was them doing like contemporary pop rock, kind of like indie rock stuff. And all the emo kids hated it at the time. And I started listening to it kind of as a fuck you, where I'm like, oh, I want to see why all the emo kids hate this. And I really like that record now. So I feel like whenever any of these emo records like went or any of these like bands that were the emo bands of the time went off and branched off to something different, then I was more inclined to go jump into them. But yeah, that stuff from like the late 90s to the early mid 2000s, I was just digging my heels in against it. And I don't want to say it all that was a mature you know, musical decision on my part, but that was where I was coming from. I realize I just talked for 25 minutes about that, but you know.
So you just talked for 15 minutes about how you like emo bands when they make non-emo records.
I guess. I mean, that's how.
I mean, I it's hard to argue with that logic, I guess.
That's sort of what happened, but like, I don't know, like how you intersect with the scene is complicated, right? Because it has to do with how old you are and what you think is going on in that scene, even that sort of
where your entry level is. No, I get that 100% with any band. You know, I hear these kids talk about how great, you know, like I said, later NoFX albums are. I'm like, oh, they suck by then. But that was where
the last NoFX album was excellent.
I'm not even talking about the last one. The last one was okay, but it was not excellent. It was okay.
No, NoFX album is excellent, but
that's not true. I think S&M Airlines is excellent. I like that 90s stuff. I love that stuff. So, but by the time a lot of these kids were coming in at, you know, So Long and Thanks for All the Shoes and all that stuff, I'm like, this band kind of sucks now. Too much ska, too soft.
Oh, Tom.
But those are their entry points. So that was the first stuff they heard, where me, it was probably White Trash or something like that was the first thing I heard. So, you know, it all depends where you start.
Along those lines, Tom, you bring up something that we should talk about, and then maybe we'll wrap up the episode. So NoFX, I mean, I'm sorry, not NoFX, but NoFX was going to play Pittsburgh at Punk and Drublic. Canceled until next year due to low ticket sales.
Do you know for sure it was due to low ticket sales, or was it a scheduling conflict?
I'm almost sure it was due to low ticket sales.
I never heard what the reason was for
putting the plug on that. They put up a post that says, hey, we're going to reschedule this till next year because there's a lot of festivals this summer, so we feel it's overcrowded, so we're going to push it till next year. They're posted almost exactly that. So that means they wouldn't cancel if they had high ticket sales, right? You know what I mean?
I know where you're going with this, John. Keep going.
Rancid is playing Philadelphia on Sunday. They booked a 14,000 people capacity venue just today, like five, or maybe it was yesterday, like 4 or 5 days before, 4 days before the show. They kicked it down to a 2,500 to 3,000 person capacity, almost one fifth, which is, it's Rancid, it's Suicidal Tendencies. It's a couple of other bands of that caliber. Meanwhile, you know, Morrissey played Philadelphia and the lawn was empty. A couple of things. Punk, like, is the era of 90s-ish punk over? I mean, if you look at ticket sales, it definitely might be. Or are people reacting? Are people tired of paying $50, $60 for punk shows, even if it's like four or five bands on the bill? Or are people just tired of high ticket sales? Or are people festival fatigue? Because there used to be literally like three festivals a year. Now there's hundreds, literally hundreds a year, you know? So, but I was very surprised that NoFX is having problems selling tickets. Grant is having problems selling tickets. Punk Rock Bowling in Asbury Park was having problems selling tickets. Not true in Las Vegas, mind you. So a lot of these biggish festival things are really having, or not medium-sized festivals, if you will, are really having problems bringing in maybe the glory days of $100 festival tickets is over.
Well, it's funny too, because I'm sure we've talked about this before, but there's a weird phenomenon with festivals where you get a cross section of crowd. So even at a punk festival, you'll have non-punk people that are just like festival bros that love festivals. But the fact of the matter is they throw all these bands together and they draw a huge crowd, but we forget sometimes that the individual bands don't necessarily draw such a big crowd. And I always make the example of Motorhead, who, man, when they play a festival, there'd be 50 or 100,000 people. Oh, Motorhead, we love Lemmy. We love Motorhead. Meanwhile, when they toured, where did they play? They played 2,000 seat, you know, theaters.
True.
So, you know, this, cause you were talking about the Rancid one. So in Detroit, they're supposed to play at the Masonic Temple, which is, gosh, such a cool old building, but say 5,000, and it got moved to the suburbs to a place that holds about 2,000. So they had the same issue, but I think they just might be, you know, biting off more than they can chew, or expecting more ticket sales than they actually have any chance of getting. But you know, that being said, you know, for a punk band to draw 2,000 people is still respectable, but I think, because of these festivals, I think it's kind of blown out the ego of some of these bands. Because the fact of the matter is, there's only of the punk festivals, true punk headliners. I'm not talking about Riot Fest, which is essentially a rock and roll festival at this point. But the punk fest, you know, there's only really a handful of headliners. There's Rancid and Offspring and NoFX and Dropkick Murphys. And, you know, there's probably a dozen of them that you can count on. But none of them are playing huge places. Unless you take like a Green Day or a Blink-182 into account, which, once again, but not really punk bands.
Even that, Green Day is not just touring on their own. It's Green Day, Weezer, and Blink.
But we talked about this last week. They're playing huge places, John. They're playing 50,000 cap places. I don't know if Green Day could do that on their own or not. But they'd be this tour they're doing. And not only that, I just got the stuff in the. You know, I'm on various mailing lists and stuff. I'm sure you are too, John. But you know, I got the code for pre-sale tickets for that show. I looked at the date. The Detroit date is August 19th. It's 11 months away. I mean, is that crazy? How do you even plan a tour a year in advance? I'm not going. Mm-hmm. I thought my daughters might really want to go and I would consider, but they don't seem that interested. So I'm sort of relieved.
So that actually, a question about like the draws here, really, I think we should loop in this other story that we had talked about.
Oh, we're going to do two stories?
Yeah, we'll do two whole stories. No, but this one. This one factors in here. So John's question was like what is it about these like 90s era punk bands that's not drawn anymore, right? Well, I wonder if it is a problem with that era or if it's a problem with, say, the North America, because we announced the lineup this past week for the Rebellion Fest in the UK. So they announced the early details for the 2020 edition of that event. It's happening in Blackpool. It runs from August 6th through 9th of next year. So the bands playing this thing include Steve Ignorant playing Crass, Sham 69, Angelica Upstarts, the Anti-Nowhere League, GBH, Dickies, UK Subs, Neville Staple Band, The Boys, Scream, MDC, lots more, right? So
right up this old timers alley, this festival.
Right,
I would love to go
right up the old timers alley, but I'm trying to find the numbers on it, because I bet you that like if we can find the numbers as we're Googling around while we're recording this show, something like Rebellion Fest probably draws like an insane amount of people.
I actually think it does.
I don't think so. I don't think it's that big.
I think it actually isn't that big.
I bet it's like 10,000 or something.
The metal fests are gigantic in Europe.
I'm in a group, a closed group, Facebook group of all these older punks, mostly English, but not all English and American. And I'm definitely on the younger end of the crowd. I'd say most of it's mid-50s. And I see all the pictures and stuff from Rebellion, which happened not that long ago, a month ago or something, whatever it was. And it is an old crowd. And but that being said, I would love to go. It looks like fun. I think it's got a level of camaraderie, probably due to the fact that everybody's older, more so than like, you know, Riot Fest. You're not going to probably make a lot of new friends at a Riot Fest at this point.
But see, here's the thing with Rebellion Fest, and listen, Rebellion Fest is cool. I'd love to see Steve Ignorant do all Crass again. But
lots of small club shows kind of thing.
But it's all old bands, so is that like depressing? You know, like
well, but there'll be a Teenage Bottle Rocket, a Pair, stuff like that. There's some new
I don't think there is though, man.
No, there is. I remember last year's lineup, there were some younger bands there. I mean, not a ton. But you know, you look at a band like Anti-Nowhere League, man, they can't hardly play anywhere in the US. Rebellion 2019. Let me see. I know there was some younger bands.
Well, I mean, there's a few, but
it's definitely an older lineup.
Most of the Rebellion bands most of the younger bands at Rebellion Fest are like derivative bands, like bands, young guys doing Oi or young guys doing Scott. Like there's not a whole lot of exciting new-ish kind of bands, you know?
Right.
Let me finish. I'm not dissing Rebellion Fest. That's cool, but to me that might be kind of listen, we're not getting paid anything by Punk Rock Blowing at all these days. But I think Punk Rock Blowing does a really good job of mixing the classics with the newbies, you know.
But it's still 75% kind of orthodox punk bands. They've become the American version of Rebellion to a certain extent. But you're right, they mix in some new stuff. But the headliners, other than a couple of years ago when they had like At the Drive-In and everybody threw a shit fit, for the most part, it's older bands.
Well, I think you got a headline. I mean, unless there's like some like new band that's like, well, there are no gigantic new punk bands because that era, I mean, there's very few gigantic bands of any genre because music is so diversified now or spread out. You know, there's a few jumbos. But like Post Malone or whatever, but what's your name?
Post Malone, as big as he is and as many records as he's selling, you know, to me, he hasn't proven to have enough staying power to really take seriously yet. He's still a flash in the pan to me. I mean, at least like a Taylor Swift has had a career projectile of her career.
I'm not saying Post Malone is good because I think he's terrible, but I mean, like, he could headline a festival is what I'm saying.
He looks like he should be working at Little Caesars.
He does.
which is the lowest of the low in the town I live in.
but what I'm saying is, are there any new punk bands that could headline a festival? I don't know if you'll ever see that again.
That could headline? No.
That's what I'm saying, you know.
What I'm curious about, and I don't disagree with you at all about Punk Rock Bowling, though. They have done a really good job with the mix, right? But what I was kind of getting at is that you have something like Rebellion that is going to sell an order of magnitude more tickets than one of these like domestic Rancid No Effects shows here.
Sure.
So why is that? Is that just that like the Europeans are just more on board with going to see punk rock stuff? Is it that the late 70s?
Don't you think the ticket, wouldn't it be about on par with like a punk rock bowling, which is much smaller than a Riot Fest? What's punk rock bowling? That's 10,000-15,000 people, right, John?
No, actually it's smaller than you might think. It's actually like 6,000 people per day or something. So like 12,000 over both days.
So it might be actually closer in line with that than you think, Adam, the Rebellion.
I just have this like this stereotype in my head of these like European festivals, and maybe I'm just thinking of metal festivals.
Well,
I don't know.
Festivals are hundreds of thousands, could be hundreds of thousands.
Like this is crazy. This year, Wacken sold out. Like, no, Wacken.
Is that how it's pronounced? Wacken. Man, I've been saying it wrong for 20 years. Vakken. I thought it was Wacken. Like let's go listen to some metal and do some Wacken.
In America, we say Wacken, but it's actually Wacken. But that sold out. Like, the day tickets went on sale, which is the first for them.
Knowing the lineup.
Yeah, it was like 150,000 tickets that sold out in a day. Like, that's insane.
But there's that metal festival down in southern Illinois that has yet to take off. It's called Full Terror Assault. And the owners are really dedicated to it, and it keeps going year after year, but they don't draw more than a couple thousand.
Well, metal's more popular in Europe, even though in America it's pretty popular right now.
All rock and roll in general, guitar music is more popular in Europe, honestly.
But dance music's huge in Europe, too.
What is?
Dance music.
Oh, dance music?
It's huge in Europe, bigger than here.
I mean, well, there's perhaps.
I think that really, I guess what we're coming at here is that like we should just burn this whole continent to the ground because it's not helping anyone.
At least the northern part of it.
Yeah, everything like north of Mexico.
I guess that probably includes me too. And then John, I guess we're all sort of on the northern half.
Here's the answer. Give John, Adam, and Tom $15 million to throw a festival, and they're not, is it a non-recoupable $15 million?
Dude, the bands I like, I could do it for $15,000.
Agree. Listen, it's hard. It's hard out there making a buck in punk. Let me tell you, it is hard out there making a buck.
It is. Here we are, though, rolling in the dough. We didn't play any songs. We didn't talk about any news. Oh, the exciting news that I wanted to bring up—totally non sequitur. I just read, John. It just looks like you more than Adam, probably. Canadians don't really appreciate the finer things, you know. Danzig's going to start shooting his new movie in October.
I can't wait to see the first one. I know,
and I'm dying to see it too. Oh, I mean, man. If it comes out on DVD, I'll probably just buy it. Just
the thing is, will it ever come out? He's got so many projects that just never come out.
It'll probably come with like a free dirty comic book for all your wacky needs. I'm sorry, Wacken.
That Sam Hain comic is the worst. Adam, have you seen the comic that comes with the Sam Hain box set? It is like it makes me question Danzig as a whole. I'm a Danzig maniac. but the Sandman comic book, Sandman comes with a comic book, and it's
he's a perv. It's a perv. He's a 65-year-old perv.
It looks like it was drawn by like a 14-year-old that has like a little talent, but not that much. And it's him, and it's like Erie Vaughn, and it's like a groupie, and she's like, let's do this. And then like Dan's like, and Erie Vaughn like, do you want to do it? We don't want there to be any hard feelings. And she's like, yeah, let's do it. And so she starts blowing one of them, and the other one's banging her from behind. And the one from behind turns into like the Sandman monster, and he like blows her in half because his wiener grows so big. And like that's the comic, and that's in the Sandman box set. It's like Danzig is so like, his music is so serious, and some of it's so evocative of like existential questions. And then it includes a comic of Pony. Illustrated comic book of him with his wiener growing so big that it blows a woman in half.
Well, his whole comic book company, now granted the artwork is a lot better, but isn't it just basically dirty, smutty comic books?
It's porno comics.
it's two great things that are even better together.
The guy's an enigma. He really is.
But
I
heard that box set. Do you have the same hand box set, John?
Oh, what? Tom.
Okay, so I do too. The VHS one. You too, or you got DVD?
I've got the VHS one.
So I heard these things are going for crazy dollars. I mean, it's so much so that I might actually even consider getting rid of mine. But the only reason I really bought it was because I did not have a copy of Unholy Passion. And the only way you could get it at that time was by the box set. So I bought it. I don't know what it was, 50, 60 bucks, whatever. It was brand new, you know, brand new when it came out. I never knew all that later Danzig stuff was so limited.
I'm so comfortable ceding the Danzig fandom to you two gentlemen, and just looking on, if I
can work him into every episode, I feel like I've contributed my part.
Adam, don't you want to run out and buy some Danzig comics now?
Now, if Danzig released like a tape of 25 copies, that might fit better. Are we playing any music on this episode?
No. We're doing an act of defiance, and we're not playing
any music. If it was a little more lo-fi, you might be able to get into it. Oh, you guys are killing me.